Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Teleforum. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. Today, we're hosting a Practice Group Teleforum panel discussion conference call on Business Roundtable versus SEC, the D.C. Circuit case on shareholder access. Our moderator today is Villanova University School of Law Professor Robert Miller. Please note, as always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. Professor Miller, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean, very much. I'm going to talk for just 1 or 2 minutes to set the background for our discussion today. As you know, our topic is Business Roundtable versus the SEC and the future of proxy access. Now, as everyone involved in corporate law and corporate governance knows, the separation of ownership and control is fundamental to the corporate system. With very limited exceptions, shareholders do not influence corporate actions directly. Their influence is indirect and is exercised through the election of directors. The election of directors, of course, is governed by state corporate law. In theory, absent some limiting provision in the corporation's charter or bylaws, any shareholder could attend the annual meeting of shareholders, nominate whomever he pleased for election as a director, and attempt to convince his fellow shareholders at the meeting to vote for his candidate. In reality, of course, very few shareholders find it in their interest to attend shareholder meetings. Rather than vote in person, they vote by proxy. And this is where federal law comes into play for the solicitation of proxies for voting of shares in public companies, whether by incumbent management or anybody else, is governed by the federal securities laws, most importantly, the rules promulgated by the SEC in Regulation 14A. So shareholders vote by proxies solicited in accordance with the securities laws. But proxies given to whom? Well, as everyone knows, every year the incumbent directors renominate themselves, or else nominate individuals they have selected for election to the board, and then solicit proxies from the shareholders to vote their shares essentially in favor of themselves. They do this, of course, at the corporation's own expense. Usually, incumbent managers are the only person soliciting proxies, and so, almost invariably, incumbent directors or their nominees are reelected. Now, although a shareholder wanting to nominate his own candidates for election as directors could solicit proxies in favor of his candidates, in fact, this rarely happens. One possible explanation for this fact is that, by and large, incumbent directors do a reasonably good job, and shareholders think it is unlikely that replacing them with new managers would materially increase shareholder value. But there's a more sinister explanation as well, and it is that running a proxy contest is very expensive. Running a contest involves identifying suitable candidates, convincing them to serve, drafting a proxy statement that complies with Regulation 14A, filing it and clearing it with the SEC, hiring a proxy solicitation firm, and mounting a public relations campaign against incumbent management. And all these expenses will be borne by the insurgent shareholder. Moreover, even if the campaign is successful and the new directors improve the management of the company and increase the stock price, the shareholder who mounted the campaign will receive only a fraction of the benefits, a fraction equal to his proportionate share in the corporation. All the other shareholders, who incur no risk and no expense in mounting the proxy contest, will free ride on the insurgent shareholders' efforts. If this is right, then it may seem that we have a genuine problem. It could be that shareholders would very likely often want to replace incumbent management, but the cost of doing so, aggravated by the free rider problem, prevent them from doing so. This is the problem that proxy access was meant to solve. Why not allow shareholders to nominate candidates for election as directors and require the incumbent management to include these nominations along with their own in the corporation's own proxy statement? In short, why not make the corporation pay the cost of the proxy contest and indeed create a minor efficiency by circulating only one proxy statement rather than two proxy statements? For a long time, there was doubt whether the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 conferred on the SEC authority to require public companies to grant shareholders access to their proxies. The Dodd-Frank Act removed that uncertainty and authorized, though did not require, the SEC to promulgate a rule mandating proxy access. Soon thereafter, in a split decision, the Commission decided to implement Rule 14A11, which allowed shareholders or groups of shareholders working together who held at least 3% of the company's common stock for at least 3 years to nominate individuals for up to one quarter of the directorships up for election, other than in connection with a possible takeover of the company. The Business Roundtable and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce promptly sued the SEC, alleging that the Commission's adoption of the rule violated the Administrative Procedure Act and certain provisions of the Securities Exchange Act, primarily because the Commission failed adequately to consider the rule's effect upon efficiency, competition, and capital formation. On July 22nd of this year, the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit agreed, holding that the commission was arbitrary and capricious in promulgating Rule 14A11 and vacated the rule. So this raises a great many important questions. First, concerning the case itself, primarily whether the D.C. Circuit's opinion was correct, but also about the future of proxy access, whether the SEC will attempt to implement a similar rule in the future, perhaps using better procedure. And, of course, there's the larger question of whether a proxy access is just a good idea at all. To discuss these questions, we have a very distinguished panel. First, Mr. Eugene Scalia, a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, who was lead counsel for Business Roundtable in the case. Second, Mr. Ted Allen, who is governance counsel and head of publications at Institutional Shareholder Services. Third, Professor Stephen Bainbridge, the William D. Warren Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles School of Law. And finally, Professor Jay Brown, Professor of Law at the University of Denver Law School. Before we go to Mr. Scalia, I just want to note that we did invite the SEC and Mr. Scalia's opposite number on the case to participate in the call, but very understandably, the SEC staff doesn't want to express an opinion on the case prior to the commission's deciding how it will proceed. With that, I turn things over to Mr. Scalia.
Robert, thank you. And I think that your presentation sets up the case well. In a nutshell, the SEC adopted what it called Rule 14A11, the so-called proxy access rule, which provided that going forward, public companies were required to include in the company's proxy materials nominating materials associated with a nominee who was put forward by a shareholder who held 3% of the company's shares for at least 3 years, or a group of shareholders who held 3% of the company's share for a period of 3 years or more. As Robert mentioned, there are existing means by which interested shareholders can put forward director candidates. They can conduct a proxy contest. Also of note, very recently, the state of Delaware had amended its corporate law, which is the corporate law that applies to more than 50% of American public companies. That law had been amended to make clear that corporate bylaws could be amended to permit an access mechanism like the one I described, or one that's slightly different, for example, that could say you have got to have 5% of shares or 10% of shares, or maybe just 2%, and you could change the period holding requirements as well. So Delaware had made clear that the company founding documents could be amended to facilitate access. And at the same time that it adopted Rule 14A11, the SEC also adopted a new rule that makes clear that shareholders may put forward shareholder proposals that the shareholders can then vote on to decide whether the shareholders in the company, rather than the federal government, want to have an access mechanism. And again, that mechanism could be identical. It could be 3% held for 3 years, or it could be something different, 5%, 10% held 2 years or whatever. So you have these sort of parallel rules, 14A11, the one we're talking about today, the so-called proxy access rule. And then you had this sort of shareholder choice option whereby the shareholders could vote on whether they thought an access mechanism was worthwhile. That rule, the shareholder choice mechanism, was not challenged, although it was stayed at the same time as the rule that was adopted by the commission. I'll just sort of briefly describe some of the key issues and points that were decided by the court. One of the arguments that my clients made in the case was that the SEC had not reliably estimated how frequently this new proxy access mechanism would be used. That was important for a couple of different reasons. First, the commission is required under the securities laws to consider the effects of its actions on efficiency, competition, and capital formation. Efficiency, competition, and capital formation. There actually are three prior D.C. Circuit decisions invalidating SEC rules in whole or in part for their failure to consider this very question. A form of cost-benefit analysis. What is going to be the economic effect on the company of the rule? So frequency mattered because how frequently you use it is going to affect how great the financial impact on the company is going to be. But, of course, frequency is important as well because It goes to how great a demand there is for this mechanism, how important it really is, how valued an alternative to election contests under the traditional proxy contest approach, how valuable an alternative this really is. You know, as the court noted, the SEC said two quite different things about frequency. When estimating the rule's costs, it predicted that the new access mechanism would actually be used less frequently than traditional proxy contests. Now, that was puzzling because, as Robert laid out, the premise of the rule was it's too hard to have a traditional proxy contest. We need something else that's easier so that shareholders are better able to put forward director candidates. Let's have them free ride on the company proxy at the expense of all other shareholders was the solution. And yet when it came to estimating the cost, the SEC said, well, we actually don't think it's going to be used all that often. We made it really hard to use. It's, in fact, easier to mount a proxy contest. That was puzzling and I think in itself a bit arbitrary and capricious for the agency to be putting this rule forward with the claim that it's going to be a terrific, easier mechanism to use to conduct proxy contests, but then to turn around and say it's actually not going to be used all that often. But worse yet, elsewhere in the rule, where it was tallying up the rule's benefits, the commission switched gears and said that proxy access would be used a lot. It relied upon one commenter's estimate that that the rule would be used by 15% of American public companies annually. It relied upon a Chamber of Commerce assertion that use of the access mechanism would be, quote, customary, quote. And so this bothered us as petitioners, and it bothered the court. By the way, here's part of what the court said in sort of summarizing its decision. It said, quote, the commission inconsistently and opportunistically framed the cost and benefits of the rule, failed adequately to quantify certain costs or to explain why those costs could not be quantified, neglected to support its predictive judgments, and contradicted itself, end quote. So pretty serious stuff. A couple other issues that we identified that ended up being important to the court's decision. One was how intensely companies would oppose access nominees and therefore how costly this rule would be. Again, cost being something that the commission was required by statute to consider. The commission acknowledged that commenters estimated that election contests could be as much as $14 million apiece, but the commission said, well, these costs will be less to the extent that corporate management decides not to oppose an access nominee. The problem with that, the court found, was that there was no evidence and no reason to believe that corporate directors and management would decide not to oppose an access candidate. We can talk more about the reasonableness of that projection, but there are several reasons why it was not a realistic projection at all, and that troubled the court. Third, use of the rule by unions and state government funds. This was state pension funds. This was very important. Labor unions and state pension funds are among the most activist shareholders. They were very active commenters, and they were believed to be the people most likely to be using the rule when it was adopted. Several commenters noted concerns with that, said that union pension funds and government pension funds have different interests than your average shareholder and might misuse the access mechanism. There were specific ways the access mechanism might be used that were pointed out by commenters. Somewhat remarkably, in my judgment, the commission never even mentioned labor union pension funds or government pension funds in talking about how the access mechanism would be used or abused. That also troubled the court. They thought that some attention ought to be given to how this mechanism would be used or abused by its predicted most frequent users. And the court identified that as something else to be looked at. Fourth and finally, we had pointed out that at times the commission blamed the cost that its rule would cause on the pre-existing right that shareholders have to nominate and elect directors. They said at several different points in the rule, well, there are going to be some costs here, but those costs result from the fact that you have these rights under state law. Our point was, well, wait a minute, you're imposing additional marginal costs. You have to take account of those costs, own up to them. Even more remarkable, when tallying the rule's benefits, not once did the commission say, yeah, there are benefits here, but after all, those benefits actually arise from state law anyway, so don't pat us on the back too hard. I think when the court said that the analysis by the agency seemed opportunistic, that was such a case where, depending on whether it was a cost or a benefit, they ended up either blaming states or taking credit for themselves. So those were some of the main issues. We actually had advanced certain other arguments in our brief that the court did not reject but just did not reach. And maybe the most important was simply, again, if proxy access and the ability to use the company's proxies to put forward candidates is such a terrific thing for companies, let shareholders decide that. Let shareholders adopt that mechanism if they think it's worthwhile. Let's not have the federal government ordain it.
Thank you, Mr. Scalia. Our next panelist is Mr. Ted Allen, Corporate Governance Counsel and Head of Publications at Institutional Shareholder Services.
Thank you very much. I will let the other panelists address some of the administrative law issues in the opinion, but I wanted to talk about some of the other concerns about 14A11 and talk about how activist investors may respond to this ruling. The first point I wanted to make is that we believe that access contests will be exceedingly rare, even rarer than the SEC estimated in its rulemaking release. Recent proxy fight trends suggest that access contests will be quite rare. In recent years, proxy fight activity has continued to decline. During the first 6 months of this year, my company, ISS, issued recommendations in just 9 proxy fights, as compared to 14 during the same period in 2010 and 25 in the first 6 months of 2009. The design of the rule ensures that it will be used rarely. An analysis of 13F filings by the SEC found that just 1/3 of U.S. public companies have an eligible shareholder that's held a 3% stake for at least 3 years. The 3-year requirement all but ensures that it won't be used by hedge funds. At most companies, it would take a large coalition of long-term investors, such as public and labor funds, working together to take advantage of the rule, which would require significant coordination and reduce the chances of special interest candidates. We expect that investors would use 14A11 responsibly and primarily as a leverage tool. We expect to see only a handful of access contests a year, and primarily at widely held large cap companies that have faced high profile boardroom controversies. Labor and public funds have limited resources for public relations and solicitation expenses, and we expect that they would only try to nominate directors where there is some reasonable probability of success. The experience of overseas markets is also instructive in this area. The UK, Germany, and most of the European nations have access provisions, but there's not been explosion in shareholder nominees. An ISS analysis of 13 markets found just a total of about 87 shareholder candidates over a 3-year period from 2007 to 2009. Another important point worth considering is that there's no guarantee that these access candidates will succeed. Even in traditional proxy fights where the dissidents have far more resources, they won representation in just half of the proxy contests this year and 38% of the contests in 2010. The experience of shareholder proposals on access is also instructive. Following the Second Circuit's AIG decision in 2005, investors were able to file access bylaw proposals during the 2006 proxy season. 4 proposals were filed, and 3 went to a vote. 2 of the targets were large cap companies, United Health Group and HP, that had faced high profile governance controversies. While these proposals won more than 40% support, a good showing for a first time shareholder proposal, they didn't win majority support. Had investors nominees rather than just an access bylaw proposal been on the ballot at these two companies, it's most likely the support level would have been even lower. Our experience is that investors are much more likely to support a governance reform proposed by a dissident candidate than actually vote for the dissident candidate. The widely publicized Vote No campaign by union and public funds at Massey Energy in 2010 illustrates this point. Investors overwhelmingly supported shareholder proposals seeking board declassification and majority voting, but less than half of them were willing to vote against the directors on the ballot this year. Another important consideration is that many of these threatened access contests that would occur would be likely to settle. In the realm of traditional proxy contests, the number of settlements often exceeds the contests that actually go to a vote. For instance, our data shows there were more than 37 settlements in both 2010 and 2009, and 51 settlements in 2008. In addition, access contests will be more likely to settle than traditional proxy contests because most public and labor funds are not motivated by a desire to control the board or to obtain operational changes, they typically will settle for governance changes and a meaningful role in the selection of new directors. Occidental Petroleum's settlement with Relational and CalPERS last year is a good example of this phenomenon. And finally, I wanted to address how investors will respond to the court's decision. In a recent letter to SEC Chairman Mary Shapiro, the Council of Institutional Investors, which represents public and labor funds, urged the SEC to seek en banc review. This group has echoed concerns by other commenters that the panel's rationale in the decision would make it very difficult for the SEC to defend other rules. Many activists and other observers appear to believe that the commission couldn't possibly fare any worse before the full D.C. Circuit or before the Supreme Court. One of the most interesting parts of the investor group letter is that the group asked the SEC to keep the stay on Rule 14a8 in place during any appeal or reconsideration of proposed Rule 14a11. One might expect that investors would be eager to file shareholder bylaw proposals this year or next year, including resolutions with lower thresholds, such as 1% or 1% holding period. However, activist investors have been divided on the merits of lifting the stay and filing Rule 14a8 proposal in 2012. Some believe that a few strong results would prod the SEC to revise the rule and not let it languish. At the same time, there is concern that filing a large number of shareholder proposals will just lend support to corporate arguments that Rule 14a11 is not necessary and that private ordering should be allowed to work. Investors will be watching closely to see what the SEC does. And now I turn it back to the other panelists.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Next up, Professor Stephen Bainbridge, UCLA Law School.
Thank you. I'm going to focus my remarks on federalism issues, broader federalism issues that the ruling by its nature, having focused on administrative procedure aspects, didn't reach, but which are, I think, lurking in the background as we consider where the SEC is likely to go in the future and how the SEC, whether the SEC, should continue to press proxy access. We know, of course, that it traditionally has been state law that determined the rights of shareholders, including the rights, the voting rights of shareholders, and that the first place one must look for the powers of corporate directors is in the relevant state of incorporation's corporation law. As Justice Powell said in the CTS case, corporations are creatures of state law, and it is state law that is the font of corporate directors' powers. Now, of course, ever since the New Deal securities legislation, Congress has involved itself episodically in the regulation of corporate governance. And the division of responsibility between states and the federal government is contentious because there are a number of interest groups with skin in the corporate governance game. These include corporate managers, shareholders, unions, consumers, NGOs, and even anti-corporate populist movements. In Delaware, most of these groups are relatively powerless. Instead, the three dominant interest groups in Delaware are corporate officers and directors, investors, and, of course, the Delaware State Bar. In contrast, at the federal level, other interest groups have considerable influence, diluting the power of the interests that dominate Delaware. In particular, Washington is subject to national public opinion and populist sentiment, which Delaware is largely insulated. Now, this is okay because in ordinary times, Washington typically has more important, or at least what it thinks are more important issues on its plate than corporate governance. As we saw in Sox and Dodd-Frank, however, at the end of a bubble period, federal regulatory action becomes likely. In the euphoria associated with a bubble, regulators and private gatekeepers tend to let their guard down, and potential frauds have an explosion of opportunity, while investors become both more greedy and more trusting. That effect is a boom in fraud during bubbles, especially towards the end, when everybody is trying to keep the music going. When the bubble inevitably bursts, investigators reviewing the rubble begin to turn up evidence of speculative excess and even outright fraud. investors burnt by losses from the breaking of the bubble and outraged by evidence of misconduct create populist pressure for new regulation. It is in the post-bubble environment, when scandals and economic reversals occur, and when corporate transactions grab the attention of the media, that Congress typically acts. In these situations, the venue for regulatory action shifts from Delaware to Washington. And as a result, interest groups frozen out of the Delaware process have an opportunity to participate meaningfully in the legislative and regulatory processes. Because such periods typically involve an upswing in populist anger, they offer windows of opportunity for well-positioned policy entrepreneurs to market their preferred ready-made solutions at a time when Congress is unlikely to devote much effort to reflective deliberation. Indeed, according to my colleague at UCLA, Stuart Banner, this pattern of boom, bust, and regulation can be seen far back into the 19th century. Dodd-Frank and proxy access, of course, were simply the most recent of these patterns. Now, as has been documented, I think, by some of the earlier speakers, proxy access worked a fairly considerable intrusion into state law. And so perhaps the question is whether we should be concerned by this pattern of creeping federalization of corporate governance. And really the question, and this is obviously a question on which I think Professor Brown and I have often disagreed, is how much do we trust Delaware versus how much do we trust Washington? Delaware has competition. Pennsylvania and Nevada have long been lurking in the wings, seeking to provide competition to Delaware and to acquire larger numbers of corporate charters. Potential for competition thus incentivizes Delaware to constantly update and improve its law. The local bar in Delaware has a strong interest in maintaining Delaware's dominance, and of course the local bar has been an active and I think generally valuable participant in the continuing evolution of Delaware law. Now, although the empirical evidence is hardly contested, I think the better evidence does tend to suggest that Delaware's dominance of corporate governance has had efficient results. Roberta Romano's event study of corporations changing their domicile by reincorporating in Delaware, for example, found that such firms experienced statistically significant positive cumulative abnormal returns. In other words, reincorporating in Delaware increased shareholder wealth. I think the evidence in general tends to support that claim. Now, no one seriously doubts that Congress has power, if it so chooses, under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, to preempt Delaware corporate law at will, as it has been doing piecemeal ever since the New Deal securities laws. Unfortunately, federal intrusions in corporate governance have typically proven unwise and regrettable. We saw that the fact that the federal government tends to respond only to financial bubbles and then in ways that do not permit reflexive deliberation results in the adoption of what Roberta Romano has aptly called quack corporate governance. Now, that's a problem because ousting the states from their traditional role as the primary regulators of corporate governance has a number of adverse consequences. First, as we've noticed, Delaware is subject to competition. Washington is not. As Justice Brandeis pointed out a long time ago, the advantage of competition in a federal system is that a single state can serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country. Secondly, The uniformity, or relatedly, I should say, the uniformity imposed by federal law precludes experimentation with differing modes of regulation. And as the sphere of federal domination grows, the room for new and better regulatory ideas to be developed shrinks. Competitive federalism, finally, in closing, I would observe, promotes liberty as well as shareholder wealth. When firms may freely select among multiple competing regulators, oppressive regulation becomes impracticable. If one regulator overreaches, as New Jersey famously did at the beginning of the 20th century, firms will exit its jurisdiction, as they did, and go to Delaware, and move to a regulator that is more laissez-faire. In contrast, where there is but a single regulator, such that exit by the regulated is no longer an option, an essential check on excessive regulation is lost. Hence, I believe we have to see proxy access as part of an ongoing battle between those who support the federalization of corporate governance and those of us who think that such federalization is likely to result in less effective, less efficient, and less desirable rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Bainbridge. Now, Professor Jay Brown, University of Denver School of Law.
You know, the problem with being last is when you prepare remarks, you have to throw them out the window by the time you hear what everyone has to say. A few comments. You know, Steve Bainbridge is right that one of the things that's going on here, and access is a piece of that, is an increasing federalization of corporate governance. You saw a lot of that in Sarbanes-Oxley. You saw more of it in Dodd-Frank. And it's a fair issue to debate whether that's appropriate or not. But the one thing you have to put on the table when you talk about it is the utter unmitigated failure of Delaware to adequately regulate certain kinds of issues and, frankly, protect the interest of investors. I mean, Dodd-Frank, one of the big things in it was compensation. And, you know, there's a strong-held belief out there that the standards for compensation contributed to the financial crisis. And what one can, I think, say is that state law does not impose any meaningful set of limits on the way compensation is determined and paid by boards of directors. So some of what you see is not just other interest groups suddenly appealing to the federal government. Some of what you see is deficiencies in the state system and then appeals to the federal system because the state system can't or won't fix it. My own view on a lot of these issues is if it could be fixed at the state level, it should be. But in many instances, that's just not going to be the case. With respect to shareholder access, you know, in the rulemaking process, there was a study that was put in, and there are a lot of numbers, so you can throw them around, but in 2008, there were 50 proxy contests. How many public companies are there? Well, it's a, you know, moving number, but it's between 12 and 14,000 public companies. So between, you know, in sort of less than 0.1% of the cases, is there ever any competition for the board? That means effectively management picks the board directors and they're always elected and you have no chance of being really removed by shareholders in any meaningful sense. The only way you can really be removed is through a proxy contest and those almost never happen. So one of the things that Access is trying to do is to open up a little bit the nomination process in an effort, frankly, to focus directors a little bit more on the interests of shareholders rather than the interests of management. But having said all of that, you know, reasonable people disagree. The evidence on it is mixed. It's a fundamentally a policy question. In Business Roundtable versus the SEC, the court is not there to make policy decisions, but that's exactly what it did. You know, there's no question about the SEC's rulemaking authority. As I think Robert Miller said early on, Dodd-Frank simply resolved it. Section 971 of Dodd-Frank basically says the SEC can adopt an access rule, and it really is incredibly broad. It says, under such terms and conditions as the commission determines are in the interest of shareholders and for the protection of investors. In other words, the limits, the time periods, the share ownership, SEC can just determine what it wants. So the authority for the SEC is just very, very clear, and certainly after Dodd-Frank. So what was the court doing here? The court's sole role here was to make sure that the SEC did it well. I shouldn't say the sole role. There were some issues, as Mr. Scalia mentioned, plenty of issues, including First Amendment issues and things like that. But fundamentally, the approach of the court here was, did the SEC do it right procedurally under the Administrative Procedure Act and under this additional review requirements that it has to look at competition, efficiency, and capital raising? The standard that the court is supposed to use in a case like this, as was cited in the briefs and cited in the cases, was the SEC not negligent, not sloppy, not even mistaken, really. It's a standard of irrationality. It's that there has to be a rational connection between what the SEC concludes, what it and the evidence that's in the record. Now, if you go back, and arbitrary and capricious as the legal standard here is the most common litigated administrative law issue. I ran arbitrary and capricious through the Supreme Court file and got 294 hits. I ran it through the U.S. Court of Appeals file where most of the issues of rulemaking are decided, and in the last 10 years, I got almost 3,000 hits. This issue is dealt with all the time. There are plenty of cases and authority out there on arbitrary and capricious, on the record, on cost-benefit analysis. But if you go and you look at this opinion, there's almost no law in it. There's one Supreme Court case, and this is a very famous case from the early 1980s, when the Supreme Court overturned an effort to get rid of a rule that would have mandated airbags and seatbelts. And what the court said in that case, you know, there's language from Rehnquist in his concurring opinion, where he basically says the agency gave no explanation for how this was going to be the case at all. So not nitpicking the record, it's no explanation at all. When you look at the other three opinions that are cited in this case, so there are three Court of Appeals opinions, they're all written by judges on the panel. They're written by Judges Sentell and Ginsburg. So in other words, for authority for their views in this case, they cited themselves and no one else really. And when you go back and you look at those opinions, they're also quite different. The Chamber of Commerce opinion that struck down an Investment Company Act rule that would have required that there be 75% independent directors. Once again, what the court did was faulted the SEC for essentially not doing any analysis at all, any analysis of the costs of the different options that were selected there. Here in this case, the court went through, you know, when Mr. Scalia was talking about how the analysis was opportunistic, or, you know, that there were instances where they said one thing but said something that seemed slightly different. I actually disagree with much of that and disagree with the way the court characterized what the SEC did. But in any event, the issue for the court is, did the SEC act in an irrational fashion? And, you know, one of the issues, for example, when you talk about unions, it was not would unions use access and nominate candidates and all of that. It was really, would unions use union pension plans, would they use access as a mechanism to essentially as leverage in wage negotiations? And so the court said the SEC should have looked at that and assessed the costs. My read on that is that what the court is saying is that you have to assume that the pension plans will violate their fiduciary obligations to their beneficiaries, use authority that effectively belongs to the beneficiaries, and turn around and use it for the benefit of workers in wage negotiations. So what the court faulted the SEC for doing was not first assuming that there was a violation of the law effectively and then assessing the cost of the violation. And by the way, there isn't any evidence, there isn't any empirical evidence, certainly the court didn't cite any, that this in fact has actually occurred or is occurring. So add in on top of it that the court was asking the SEC to conduct an economic analysis of something that was highly speculative. So, you know, when I look at this opinion, I completely understand this is the single most controversial rule the SEC has ever adopted. The public company community is completely opposed to it. The investor community on the whole is in favor of it. There's really hardly any middle ground. It's a very difficult rule, and there are reasons to be, to sort of look at it, pros and cons. But when you look at the way the court handled it, I think the court did an analysis that I think really is not an accurate reflection of the state of the law.
All right. Thank you, Professor Brown. I will let the panelists respond to each other for a while before we take questions from the group generally.
This is Gene Scalia. I think it's been a valuable discussion. I was struck by a couple comments that Mr. Allen made regarding, first, the frequency. His estimate was that, I think his terms were that the use of a proxy access mechanism would be, quote, exceedingly rare, quote, even fewer than the SEC had estimated. I don't think that's correct, but if it is, it just, again, it calls into question the many benefits that the SEC claimed would spring from the rule, and of course shows the error the commission made when it was claiming those benefits and predicting that as many as 15% of public companies would have actual access contests every year. So even using Mr. Allen's estimates there, the commission just got it wrong. Now, another point Mr. Allen made that I think is extremely important is that a lot of the times when shareholders would like to put an access candidate forward or say they want to, ultimately they won't. There'll be some resolution, and his term was that the prospect of an access nominee would be used as leverage. And that was among the principal concerns that public companies had with this rule, that in addition to the costs of an election contest itself, that one of the principal uses made of an access mechanism would be leverage to obtain something different. So, for example, there's a fairly robust academic literature regarding, and non-academic literature for that matter, regarding the use, particularly by labor union funds, of threatened election contests as a means to obtain something different. We cited in bringing the case, for example, a book that has the title Labor's Role in the Shareholder Revolution. The book was called Working Capital, The Power of Labor's Pensions. And we cited an article called Labor's Role in the Shareholder Revolution. And the author of this article, she said that shareholder proposals can gain, quote, access to behind-the-scenes meetings with managers in which it is commonly understood that unions may discuss labor issues as well. If these negotiations proceed favorably, the notion is that the union will withdraw its shareholder proposals, end quote. So in fact, that sort of leveraging is a genuine concern. Professor Brown makes the point that, well, you know, theoretically that might involve a fiduciary breach and, you know, the like by the folks running the labor union fund. Maybe, but that wasn't a point that the SEC made. And again, it's quite remarkable that in a rule where, as even the comments of Mr. Allen indicated, the principal users are going to be labor union funds and government funds. And given the literature, Professor Bainbridge, among others, has written on it, given the literature regarding how those shareholders' interests may diverge, one would want the Securities and Exchange Commission to address the issue. Maybe they address it with Professor Brown's point. I think they need more. So this brings to the, sort of the larger point that the quality of the court's reasoning, and there's been some bellyaching about the court's rationale, which, you know, honestly, I find somewhat surprising. Just to, again, review the bidding, this was a rule whose principal users will be union and government funds. Those are investors who have interests that you could reasonably expect to diverge from other shareholders, and numerous commenters said so, and yet the commission never tackled the issue. This is a rule that was premised on greater ease of use and greater frequency of use than traditional proxy contests, and yet the commission said utterly contradictory things about how frequently it would be used. Professor Brown mentioned the APA arbitrary and capricious standard, which, among other things, by the way, says that you have to pay attention to the comments submitted and that you have to consider important aspects of the problem. I would submit that the commission failed to do so when it neglected some of the things that I just mentioned. But additionally, the SEC is under a heightened duty to consider effects on efficiency, competition, and capital formation. It becomes all the more important that it carefully review cost data when it promulgate a rule of this nature, and yet it failed to do so. And again, another just very rudimentary error to repeatedly say, well, we're not causing these costs, the states are, and then to claim all the benefits for the rule. I think the court was troubled by that. It did seem opportunistic. And it was just a basic error of the type that it's no surprise at all to see would bother a court under an APA arbitrary and capricious review standard. Just one sort of final thought on the decision. There's been a lot of speculation about what the commission might do. Will it seek rehearing en banc? Will it seek certiorari? I think there may be an initial sense in the SEC, oh, we don't like this decision. Let's do something more. Let's challenge it. I think cooler heads ought to dictate to the SEC that these kinds of errors are not errors they want to air out in front of the entire D.C. Circuit. These are very basic errors overlooking such important considerations. And it, given all the future rulemakings the SEC is going to be doing, I don't think it's ultimately a wise move for them, having lost this decision unanimously and three other cost-benefit decisions unanimously, one of which was written by Judge Rogers, by the way, not Sentel, not Ginsburg, another of which Judge Tatel sat on. I think both of them are appointed by Democrats, although in their APA decisions, the D.C. Circuit is impressively sort of nonpartisan. I think cooler heads would suggest that airing this laundry in front of the D.C. Circuit, just as the SEC is gearing up for more rules and potentially more rule challenges, cooler heads would suggest that's not a wise course.
Any other panelists want to respond? I'm fascinated by Professor Brown's point that a union pension fund or a government pension fund that hijacks proxy access to pursue some agenda not really related to shareholder value generally, whoever the individual is doing that would be breaching their fiduciary duty. I think I agree with that. That's what Professor Brown said. Mr. Scalia indicated he probably agreed with it as well. But the question is, well, if that's what the worry is, could or should the SEC think about this possibility, given that we're saying, well, someone's going to do something illegal? But don't we always do that in corporate governance? For example, if executive compensation is excessive, that could well be because the executives are breaching their fiduciary duties of care or loyalty. And no one has ever said, by God, let's not worry about that problem because, you know, we're assuming the executives are breaching their fiduciary duties when they pay themselves too much or put their cronies on the board and so on. So I guess my real question is, shouldn't SEC rulemaking or really any type of corporate governance issue include from the outset the idea that agents are going to do bad stuff because that's what agents do?
Well, Jay Brown here, you know, a response to that is, you know, when you look at what, when the court reviews what an agency has to do for purposes of its cost-benefit analysis and its economic analysis, I think you have to broadly ask the question, do they have to assume legal violations? And then if they assume legal violations, do they have to assume, for example, that the issuers will violate their fiduciary duties in resisting access directors when it violates their fiduciary obligations to do so? You know, in other words, there's a fundamental question. There's no authority for that in the case. The court did not say, here is a Supreme Court case or a D.C. Circuit case that says you have to assume legal violations and then try to assess the cost. The other thing I would say is in this particular case, the costs involved or the incident, you know, when Mr. Scalia read the caption from the book or the quote or whatever, you know, it was somebody saying, well, they can use shareholder proposals to get meetings, and at meetings there might be conversations, you know, and that sort of thing. In other words, they can have conversations. Maybe things come up. Maybe there are meetings. Maybe things happen. What I don't see in the literature anywhere, and, of course, the court itself cited a Law Review article as authority for this proposition that you have to assess the leverage effects with unions and public pension plans. They cited a Law Review article written by a chancellor of the Delaware Chancery Court, who was really writing an article that was saying, boy, investors have different interests. You know, in other words, that quote that was in the opinion wasn't about access per se. It was just shareholders have different interests. So my view on this is, given how aggressive unions and public pension plans are with shareholder proposals, so that they're already in the market with doing things in the governance area, surely if it was more than speculative that unions and public pension plans were going to use this and violate their fiduciary duties at the same time, surely somebody would say, and here's an example. But, you know, I don't see that. I just see people who say I'm worried about it, and I take that as an honestly held accurate view that they're worried about it. But that still doesn't mean that just because you're worried about it, it isn't anything but speculative.
Renia Krackman has said as well that if it does happen, presumably the board would be in a pretty good position to expose the labor or the pension fund's ulterior motives and get get their candidates defeated on that basis too. I mean, if it is misused, there might be a sort of a natural solution, which is that the board can point it out and presumably rational shareholders would vote it down.
Yeah, this is Gene. I mean, the limitation there is that one of company's principal concerns was not that the special interest nominee actually would get elected, or indeed not even necessarily the nominee actually would be put forward as an access nominee, but that the threat would be made and the company would feel pressure to do something that otherwise would not do. It would sort of weigh those cost benefits in deciding whether to accede to the collateral demand that was being made. That is not a problem that is going to be fixed during the election itself, because again, there might not be an election. It's the leverage itself which is a concern. That leverage was not mentioned by the SEC in adopting the rule. It was not acknowledged to exist, but I can assure you it's a very serious concern of corporate directors and secretaries. It's something they do experience, and indeed there is rulemaking evidence on it. One of the real interesting part of the backstory to this rule is how important it was to the labor movement. Now, some might want to suggest that's just because labor unions happen to be the world's most conscientious shareholders. Well, there was, in fact, contrary to what Professor Brown said, record evidence of labor unions using their power as investors to further labor agenda. And that was something the SEC needed to address factually. It didn't do so. And again, it didn't even make Professor Brown's point that unions would never do such a thing because they'll always follow the law.
Wasn't there some incident with Safeway supermarkets in California? Was that discussed in the literature or perhaps in the case, or did I read that somewhere else?
Yeah, there was a widely publicized incident in California where Safeway had a dispute with its labor union. The labor union, in turn, had strong relationships with CalPERS and others, and they organized a withhold vote, that is, a campaign to withhold withhold votes in support of some of the company directors, which didn't succeed but came close to it and was certainly a very good instance of using investor muscle in order to advance a labor agenda. And again, this isn't just me speaking as somebody who happens to be a management labor lawyer. There's a literature on the subject, including an entire book largely contributed to by members of the labor movement and some in academia who are sympathetic to their objectives.
This is Ted Allen. I had a response real quick, there's time. Regarding that Safeway case, as I recall, I think that's also a good example of sort of the limitations that labor unions face if they do try to wage proxy contests, vote no campaigns, or access contests over, you know, narrower concerns. Back in 2004, Safeway, they did wage a vote no, or, I mean the labor unions did, but they only received less than 20% opposition at that company. So that vote no campaign was viewed by institutional investors as largely a failure, you know, particularly when you compare it to vote no campaigns at Disney and at other companies since then. Also, the concerns about labor unions using shareholder activism to advance narrow concerns, I believe, is somewhat overblown. Companies are not defenseless in this regard. For instance, there is provision within the shareholder proposal rule, subsection I-4, that allows companies to petition the SEC in a no-action letter to omit a shareholder proposal on the basis that it relates to a personal claim or grievance. And in the past 17 years, there's only been two cases where this is actually – there have been such requests. One was back many years ago involving Dow Jones, and Dow Jones was successful in omitting a shareholder proposal because the union at the time, there was communications from the union that related to an organizing campaign. This year, this argument was used again by a company called Penn National Gaming, and they argued that a majority voting shareholder proposal was part of a multi-year campaign of harassment by a union. The SEC staff was not persuaded. Obviously, these no-action rulings are not binding on the commission, but it illustrates that these concerns about labor unions using shareholder activism, shareholder proposals, I believe is somewhat overstated. The reality is you're not going to put up an access candidate unless you have some reasonable likelihood of winning. And to get 50% support, or at least plurality support, is very difficult in these cases.
This is Steve Bambridge. If I could just jump in very briefly. The debate over union and state and local government involvement is an important one. Another important debate, however, with all due deference to Mr. Allen, is the role that ISS and other proxy advisory services will have in the proxy access context, in which the question will be, you know, will ISS's recommendations as to how institutional investors vote influence, have a significant influence on the outcome of these contests, and also the ongoing questions about whether ISS's de facto monopoly on proxy advisory services raises conflicts of interest that we need to take a look at. One of the concerns that we have with Say on Pay and proxy access and similar shareholder empowerment rules, whether what we're really doing is empowering ISS to essentially become the de facto decider of much of corporate governance issues. And I think we need to continue to assess if we're going to go back down proxy access, need to look at the role of proxy advisory services becomes even stronger.
Should we go to the first question? It looks
yes,
like we
please.
Have one question.
Good afternoon. This is Jane Luxton at Pepper Hamilton in Washington, D.C. I'm wondering if the panel could spend a minute or two teasing out the two legal aspects of this that seem to flavor this decision, one being the APA, of course, and its arbitrary and capricious standard, the other being the special requirement in the Exchange Act of competition efficiency and capital formation. I'm curious because there are other CFA regulations that will be coming out that may not be subject to that special requirement, and I'm wondering what the views are of the panelists on the standard that will be applied in that situation.
This is Gene. I can sort of take an initial crack at that. I think what standard gets applied depends, of course, on the particular statute and provision pursuant to which the rule is issued. You'll always have the APA in the background, as you did here. The CFTC has substantial Dodd-Frank rulemaking responsibilities. It also has a heightened duty to consider effects on markets and the like. And the SEC may or may not be under the same obligation it had here in other Dodd-Frank rulemakings. It's going to depend on the particular provisions pursuant to which it's issued. Having said all that, I do think this case would have gone against the SEC even under an APA standard.
Yeah, this is Jay Brown. I completely agree with that. I completely agree with that. The court began by noting this special review obligation by the SEC. And if you go back and you look at some of the earlier opinions, some of the earlier ones, they actually will take and say, let's look at efficiency, let's look at competition, let's look at the effect on capital raising, and kind of analyze them all. This one just sort of used it as a template and then went on and effectively did a cost-benefit analysis or reviewed the SEC's cost-benefit analysis. So I completely agree that even without that special review obligation by the commission, the court would have struck this rule down on the cost-benefit analysis basis.
I think we're almost out of time. Do any of our panelists want to make any final comments?
Yes, this is Ted Allen.
Please, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to respond real quickly to what Professor Bainbridge said. Regarding, obviously, the role of ISS and proxy advisory firms was not a direct issue in this case, but I will make a couple quick points. ISS, yes, we are the largest proxy advisory firm in the U.S. There are other firms out there, such as Glass Lewis, and there are many investors that do their own analysis, particularly in high-profile or controversial matters that they vote on. Of our 1,200 clients, at least 500 of them have their own custom voting policies. So the sense that investors vote, you know, in lockstep with our recommendations is overstated. And I think in most of these high-profile cases, you know, in any kind of access contest that comes up, you know, just like in a proxy contest, I mean, most institutional investors are going to take a closer look at the issues involved and make their own determinations. It's not something that they're going to subcontract out and just sort of blindly follow whatever our recommendation might be in a particular case.
Any other responses among the panelists? Well, let me thank all of you gentlemen for being with us today. It was a great panel. We appreciate your time and giving us your views. And on behalf of the Federalist Society generally, thank you. Dean?
Well, let me thank Professor Miller. You were exclusively responsible for putting this panel together. An announcement to our audience that we have recorded this call and it will be posted as a podcast for your additional review and the review of your colleagues, perhaps. And please look for announcements from us by email of future teleforum calls. So thank you, Professor Miller.
Thank you.
With that, we're adjourned.